special report. The president is among well-wishers for Britain's Princess Kate Middleton, who says she's been diagnosed with cancer and has started chemotherapy. White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre.
Our thoughts are with the Duchess of Cambridge and her family members and friends during this incredibly difficult time.
In this Kensington Palace video, Middleton says she's well and wants to get back to work.
My work has always brought me a deep sense of joy, and I look forward to being back when I'm able. But for now, I must focus on making a full recovery.
She hasn't made any public appearances since before abdominal surgery back in January. There's been much speculation about her health. Correspondent Charlie Daggett.
That image that was released, everybody's been worried, really, about her well-being. So in one way, this will help clear up some of the confusion, but it's also going to raise concerns here about her well-being.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Peter King.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. There's 8 inches of snow on the ground in Chetek and West Allis. Everywhere in Wisconsin got at least a little snow overnight and today. Northwest Wisconsin could get socked again Sunday. Forecasters are calling for 1 or 2 feet of snow. Wisconsin voters could add 2 amendments to the state constitution April 2nd. One would outlaw private donations to local election offices. Sam Liebert is with the group All Voting is Local. He's urging people to vote no.
There's so much concern about third-party funding. Let's have that discussion in the state budget, at our local levels.
The other question would specify who can legally serve as a poll worker in Wisconsin. Democrats say the amendments would make voting harder. Republicans say they'd promote election integrity. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News. Now here's what you need to know closer to home.
For WCFW News, I'm James Kelly. If you live in Eau Claire County, you officially live in one of the healthiest counties in the country. According to a WQOW report, Eau Claire ranked above the national and state average for county health rankings and roadmaps. Health officials credited the quality of health care in the community and the willingness of residents to be engaged in the community. Officials also noted that there's some work to be done in terms of alcohol and drug misuse, and the impending closure of all HSHS and Prevea facilities will hurt overall health. Shane Helmbrecht appeared in an Eau Claire courtroom on Wednesday for a status conference. According to court documents, Helmbrecht was scheduled for a competency hearing before this hearing, but the doctor who met with him did not have all the records needed to review his case. Lawyers for both sides agreed to hold the competency hearing on April 12th, with another status conference a week prior to ensure everything is proceeding as planned. Helmbrecht is accused of killing his neighbor, Jen Ward, in 2016. And that's what you need to know. For WCFW News, I'm James Kelly.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Badger women in the Frozen Four.
Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Wisconsin Badgers women's hockey team, led by Kirsten Sims, are in New Hampshire for the Frozen Four, looking to repeat as national champions. They face off tonight against Colgate. Badgers head coach Mark Johnson.
Obviously, the magnitude of the game are higher. Everybody can see the finish line now. There's only 4 teams left, and the season's over on Sunday, and somebody's going to be a national championship Sunday afternoon, early evening.
Baseball, the Brewers lost to the Giants last night, 7-6. That snapped Milwaukee's 5-game winning streak. NBA, the Bucks down the Nets, 114-108. Giannis able to play after missing 2 games with a sore hamstring. March Madness, it's the Badgers and James Madison University. Wisconsin back in the big dance for the first time in 2 years. Max Klesman asked if they're excited for tonight's game.
For sure. Yeah, no, I can't wait. I can't wait to just go out there and shoot around and, like, put up a shot at the March Madness logo during the shoot around.
With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Cloudy skies today with spotty snow showers still possible. By tonight, we'll see some clearing as temperatures crash cold. This means we'll see a mostly sunny day tomorrow with highs in the mid-30s. All ahead of a major snowstorm smacking by Saturday night and throughout Sunday. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot. Right now, it's 30.
You know, I hope this is the best hour of your life. I'll tell you that. The KreitzCast, folks.
My conversation with Taylor Kalmus, a.k.a. Dudette.
When you go to the movies and you get to the last climactic scene, you're not just like, oh, you know what would be fun? Let's leave. Let's finish this movie in the parking lot. You guys don't know what I'm talking about, do you?
I think he's talking about...
Let's pull out of this movie theater.
KreitzCast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
Monday on Matt Mayer On Air, we talk school board elections and the good, the bad, and please make it stop. Don't miss it.
You're tapped in to the issues affecting the Valley and all of Wisconsin. Consider us the bartenders of friendly local talk. This is 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show. This is not Maggie Dawn or Liz. This is producer Anya, this strange voice. And we'd like to help you win some stuff this spring with our Ride into Spring Text to Win contest. Yes, our first ever big, big contest here on Civic Media. We're so happy to help you potentially win a blender, a bike, or a trip to the Chula Vista Resort in the Wisconsin Dells, which is, I gotta say, one of my favorites down there in the Dells. And if you would like to enter today, this is the last chance for this week, and then you have all next week to try again, then you need to text in the following word. Are you ready, Wisconsin? Your word on this snowy day is lawn. L-A-W-N, lawn. Maybe you were thinking you were going to mow the lawn, not really, in March, but now you're going to be shoveling that lawn. So if you'd like to win, text in lawn. And with that, I'm going to throw a lawn shot to our great guest hosts. We've got Liz and we've got Aaron in the chair. Liz and Aaron, take it away.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anya. I feel like somebody picked that word a week ago.
And it I was, think so too, yes.
When it was 60 degrees out. But that was false spring. And now we're back to winter. We should know
Truly.
Better. But March gets us every year. The most disappointing month. That's what I call it. Okay, so hour two, I think we're just going to keep rolling on with our discussion about plea bargaining. So Aaron was talking to us about plea colloquies. I actually wrote down how to pronounce it because I messed it up the last time. So plea colloquies being when the judge wants to hear from the defendant that they are taking responsibility for their plea, that they are voluntarily entering into their plea. Is that right, Aaron?
That is correct. That's kind of the last barrier you have, or you know, check in the system to be sure that defendant's doing what they really want. As I stated before, the first is really the prosecutor when they first sit down and look at it. And also the prosecutor, if they get an inclination when they're negotiating with the defense attorney that the defendant, you know, believes he has a legitimate defense and is not any, the prosecutor gets any sense that this defendant believes he is innocent, has a legitimate defense, the prosecutor should say, look, let's just try the thing. I mean, as a prosecutor, that is the last thing on the earth that I want to do is send someone to jail or convict someone of something they didn't do, period. So I have no interest in doing it. If they want to have a trial, let's have the trial.
So that's something that we heard from some of our judges. So we had this conversation. Aaron and I are in a group with judges and lawyers that meets for lunch every week. And this was a topic that I presented on there. And we had a really robust discussion and a really interesting discussion about it. And I was so interested and I think heartened to hear the same thing from our judges, that they take this plea colloquy really, really seriously. One of our judges says that he does not take Alford pleas. And so my understanding of an Alford plea, it's A-L-F-O-R-D, is that the defendant's not admitting guilt, but they're admitting that the prosecutors, the state, has enough evidence to convict. And this judge we were talking to says he doesn't take them. You gotta admit guilt. He does not want people accepting punishment for something that they're not going to say they actually did. We had another judge too who said when if he hears the defendant's side of the story and it sounds to him, the judge, that the defendant has a defense, he will not accept a plea from them. And that made me feel good about what I was hearing. And it made me feel good about our judiciary that they're, at least the folks that we were talking to, were really taking this seriously. And as Aaron just said, did not want to convict people that had a defense that didn't do it.
And I've actually seen that in play. You will have situations where the defendant is in the middle of the colloquy and he expresses audibly or with body language any sort of hesitancy. The judge will stop and just say, look, we're not doing this. We'll have a trial. That is fine. That's your absolute right. And I've had defendants on the record also say, yeah, you know, when they get to the end of the colloquy, no, I don't really want this. I didn't really do it. My defense attorney's saying I should do it and da da da. That's it. We're done. Let's schedule this for trial and we'll have the trial. That's your right. And let's do it.
All right. So we talked earlier about, I think, what is the biggest concern for people about plea bargaining is that disparity between what's offered at the plea and what might happen after trial. If it's too great, you might coerce innocent defendants into accepting because the risk is just too big. I think on the flip side, the kind of argument for plea bargaining, the number one thing that you hear is we do not have the resources to go to trial on more cases than what we have right now. I was reading somewhere, and I don't remember who it was that wrote this, but they said that if we even had 10% more trials, we would need more than double the resources that we have. Was that your experience as well, Aaron?
Yes, especially more populous counties like Waukesha, Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha. I mean, it would be the backlog of criminal cases would be, I can't even imagine. But even the more rural counties in the state, If they tried every single case they had, I mean, rural counties may have one, two DAs. I mean, there would be criminal cases pending for 5-6 years. I mean, that's in no one's interest. So.
Well, and I think there's a problem on the defense side as well. And I think one of our callers maybe alluded to this, but defense attorneys have a whole bunch of cases too, just like prosecutors have a whole bunch of cases. And without having more defense attorneys, and I think probably in particular ones that are paid by the state, they don't have the time to try all of these cases.
Well, that's a huge problem. And an economic reality of the criminal justice system is that a majority of the defendants you see, rural or urban environments, don't have the economic means to hire their own attorneys, period. They just don't. So then you rely on the public defender system, which they are paid by the state just as DAs are, but they are overwhelmed such that they have to, for lack of a better term, farm out a large percentage of their cases to private attorneys who will take public defender appointments. The problem with that is, and this is, again, more of a legislative systemic problem than it is a plea problem, is that for those attorneys, the amount they get paid by the state for those cases that get farmed out, they can't, I mean, economically, to take a case to trial on a homicide is very, very difficult on the amount of money they're paying them to give someone a good defense. That is a system-wide problem. And I know in talking to judges from northern counties, they don't have public defenders. They don't have attorneys that take appointments. They beg for attorneys from Milwaukee to come up there to do it. It's just, that's a bigger problem. So that without the plea bargaining system, I mean, the system would grind to a halt for that reason.
Yeah. And how about this? I mean, I think there's a good argument to plea bargaining in that not all cases are the same, right? I mean, I think that there probably should be some room to treat cases on their facts, and some are different than others, and maybe some should be treated more harshly or more leniently than others.
Absolutely. And that's where you have the human element. That's why you have defense attorneys and prosecutors that work together. Like I said, I get a kid, and I say kid, you know, 18 years old, 17, you're an adult in the criminal system. I have a 17-year-old kid that committed 3 garage burglaries. I have like 30 years of exposure. Do I want him to go to prison? Does that do anybody any good? No. So that's why I talk to him about factors. Okay, well, he's got a substance abuse issue, or he's got a terrible home life. He's got this or that, you know. Well, I take that in consideration when I plead and say, fine, not everybody's the same that sits before me. So maybe I'll offer you probation, maybe probation with some treatment, you know, with their substance abuse issue. So you got to have the human element in it. If this were just a computer system and saying you've been charged with X, you're this age, you have this many priors, this is what the recommendation will be, no one will like that system either, because that'll result in just as many inequities. So you've got to have the human system, and plea bargaining gives you that effect, because not every person that sits before you has the same background. And so you need to take in consideration multitude of factors from the state side and the defense when you're making offers or accepting them.
So how about this concern? This is something I've been thinking about as we see attorneys like you leave the district attorney's office and go into civil practice. And every time somebody leaves like that, you take all your experience with you. What about the concern that the lack of trials, right? Only 3% are going to trial. The lack of trials, then you're not training your attorneys, whether you're on the prosecutor side or on the defense side, how to be a trial attorney. And then the less you do it, the less comfortable you feel about doing it. And then maybe the more likely you are to enter into a really lenient plea, maybe on the prosecutor's side, because, oh my God, you've never done a trial before and you're really freaked out about it. Is that a concern? Is that a valid concern?
From the state side, not so much in my perspective. You're going to get trials. I mean, you're the one who's going to do that 3 or 5%. So the problem from the state has, when I say state, I mean the prosecutors, is that you may not have enough DAs, and you may throw inexperienced DAs into cases they shouldn't be handling that early in their career, but they're going to get that trial experience for better or worse. From the defense side, that's harder because, you know, defense attorneys, they may think they have a good case or may have good defenses, but the defendant knows they didn't, and they'll plead to it. So it's harder for those defense attorneys to get meaningful trial experience, especially if they're solo practitioners. They don't have anybody to talk to. There's not a solid mentoring system in place. So that's a bigger problem, but I don't know how to rectify that other than, you know, if you go into private practice and do criminal defense right away, I mean, you're going to have to try to get trial experience somewhere. The problem is, where are you getting that mentoring from? The public defender's office certainly gives you that if you go that route, but not every defense attorney goes that route. So, but I don't see that as entering into plea bargaining. It shouldn't, at least. Like, I don't want to try this case, so I'm going to offer you almost nothing as a prosecutor. So
as we roll into our next section in about a minute or so after the break, I think maybe our listeners would be interested in hearing a little bit about the jurisdictions that have tried abolishing plea bargaining. My home state of Alaska, that's where I was born and raised, where I grew up before I went to college, it abolished plea bargaining for more than a decade. So maybe we'll talk about that. New Orleans did as well, and we can talk about what those experiences were like.
Sounds good.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Matt Nair on Air.
Are record energy costs putting a squeeze on your fixed or limited incomes? With inflation rising at record levels and incomes not keeping pace, you might be one of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who are struggling to survive in the blistering heat of summer or the bitter cold of winter. While you haven't asked for it, the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help. No Wisconsin resident should ever have to face the challenge of living without heat or power or face homelessness. For a hand up, apply today and call
800-506-5596. That's 800-506-5596. Or visit www.heat.help.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show. This is producer Anya stepping in real quick before our guest hosts take it away to remind you that there's still time this hour. This is the last hour this week that you can enter in our Ride into Spring Text to Win contest. That's right. Anywhere you're hearing us across the state right now, if you text in the word lawn, that's L-A-W-N, as in the big green, or should I say the big white thing in your front yard today, is your lawn. You need to go shovel it, probably, or at least the sidewalk out to it. Lawn. Text us lawn for your chance to win what? A bike, a blender, and a trip to Chula Vista. And with that, our guest hosts, Liz and Aaron. Take it away, friends.
Thanks so much, Anya. All right, so I don't need a blender because I still have the one I got when I got married. My bike, I don't really ride that much, so I can't really justify a new one. But vacation at Chula Vista might be kind of fun.
Have you been there before?
So I have been there, but I haven't utilized the water park. And it was before I had a kid.
Well, then this seems, I'll just say I had my 11th birthday there. So I might be a little biased, but I think 11-year-olds, 21-year-olds, whatever ages everywhere would love a weekend at the Chula Vista. So.
How about 40-something-year-olds, Aaron?
How about them? Yeah.
I love all varieties of water parks, and that's probably because I have some kids at home who I've taken to the Chula Vista and other water park resorts, so it's well worth it. And I did not hear any disclaimers that I'm not eligible as a guest host, so I may text lawn before I leave here as well.
Same. And as lawyers, we are always looking for that
stuff.
That's
perfect.
Well, and our legal counsel's on vacation is the thing.
Oh, wonderful.
Why you're
free,
here.
Free
so.
For all.
Free for all.
All right. Thanks, Anya. All right. We are back. So we're going to talk about the couple of jurisdictions that actually did eliminate plea bargaining. And spoiler alert, neither of them did it permanently. But I think it's really interesting. And Alaska is the example that people look at. Because it did it for such a long time and it was the whole state. So, okay, so here's the story about Alaska. So in 1974, a guy named Avram Gross was appointed attorney general. And then because of the way that Alaska's system is set up, he had statewide supervision of all criminal prosecutions by the Alaska Department of Law. And one of the first things he did in 1975 was he declared no more plea bargaining. So at that time, sentence bargaining had been really common, right? So if you plead guilty, I'll recommend, 3 years less than it would have been. But charge bargaining, which is, we talked about these distinctions at the top of the last hour, charge bargaining, where it's like, okay, if you plead guilty, it's not going to be a felony. You're going to plead to a misdemeanor instead or something like that. That had not been very common. So, okay, 1975, no more plea bargaining. But to make this work, and I think Aaron's been talking about this a lot, you're kind of first look at this are your prosecutors who are doing the charging. Up until this point in Alaska, the police officers were the ones doing the charging. So they were doing the investigating. Aaron's grimacing. Our listeners can't hear it. They were doing the investigating, and then they were doing the charging, and then the prosecutors were stuck with whatever the police had charged. That changed under the system, and I think it had to under the system, because if the prosecutors couldn't plea bargain anymore, they needed to be the ones making the decision about what was getting charged. So what Alaska did was they set up a screening panel. They picked their most experienced prosecutors to be on this screening panel, and they were doing the screening of the cases that were brought to them. And so I got to find my statistic here. I think when the screening panel started, after a certain number of years, and I can't remember what it is in my outline here, but it went something from like, boy, let me find it here. Oh, yeah. Okay. So before the ban, prosecutors, before the screening started, prosecutors were refusing
4% of the felony cases received from the officers. And then after the ban, when the prosecutors are doing the screening, it went up to 44% of the cases. And what this ban really did, and then with the screening process as well, is it forced law enforcement to really professionalize itself and make sure that they were bringing cases to the prosecutors that were well investigated and that really should be charged. And you got to remember, I mean, Alaska in the 1970s, it had only been a state for like 15 years or something. I mean, it was kind of like still the
Wild West. Yeah,
it was still, and there was like, I don't know, 400,000 people in the entire state at that point. And when it became a state, they just basically adopted Oregon's criminal code. They didn't really have their own. So I think of this as kind of part of the growing pains for the state of figuring out what their system was going to look like. I think you probably think it's a good idea for the prosecutors to be charging the cases and not the police.
I do. And again, that's the first line of defense as far as bringing just charges that you can prove and you should prove. That's the other thing. Just because I can doesn't mean I should. The problem with law enforcement, and God bless them, they sometimes become too emotionally involved in the cases. And, you know, because they're the ones out there dealing with it every day. And if they're fighting with defendants or, you know, having to put their lives on the line, they are more emotionally involved in it, rightfully so. But they will bring in a, you know, say the defendant committed 15 crimes. That doesn't mean I should charge him with 15 different crimes. I should do what I think is right and do what I think I can prove. So
Aaron, let me ask you this in your experience. So in your experience with plea bargaining with defendants, would you get pushback from the police officers when you entered into a plea deal with somebody?
Yep, absolutely. And lots of times the argument, and I've gotten to arguments when I'm charging a case, they bring it in and I'm looking at the cop who's investigated and saying, look, this is what I think I'm charging. And there'll be arguments. Why aren't you charging them with a felony drug case, as opposed to, you know, I'm going to charge him with a misdemeanor or I'm going to recommend probation instead of prison because this is a kid who's selling because, you know, X number of reasons. I don't think I need to send him to prison or I don't think he needs a felony based on everything else I'm seeing. So, yeah, you get into those arguments and with the plea agreement, too. Same thing. But those arguments more often happen at the charging phase. Is why aren't you charging them with a felony as opposed to a handful of misdemeanors, or why aren't you charging them with the more serious felony instead of a less serious felony? Those are all the considerations prosecutors have to take into consideration to do what is right.
And Aaron, you had said that when you were making charging decisions, you would use a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, even though really the standard you had to use was probable cause. That's something that Alaska put in as a policy as well for its prosecutors that were screening, is that the standard was beyond a reasonable doubt for charging, not for probable cause. And that makes sense to me, right? I mean, if you're gonna concentrate power in, I think, your prosecutors and your law enforcement and your judges, you really do want those standards to be really high.
Right. I mean, think about it in this context. This is an example, but an OWI, person swerving, cop sees them swerving, they go over the center line. Cop walks up to the door, smells alcohol on the person. Okay, great. There's no field sobriety test done. There's probable cause to believe that person is driving drunk.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean they are driving drunk. You get the blood alcohol back and they're 0.05. Shouldn't be charging that case. So that's the difference between a beyond a reasonable doubt and what is actually probable cause that someone committed a crime.
Great. We'll continue this after the break.
Friday on Nightlight, I welcome Kristen Lyerly and Max Inc. host Terry Barr. It's Nightlight from 7 to 9 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You know, I hope this is the best hour of your life. I'll tell you that. The Cripes Cast, folks.
My conversation with Taylor Kalmus, a.k.a. Dude Dad.
When you go to the movies and you get to the last climactic scene, you're not just like, oh, you know what would be fun? Let's leave. Let's finish this movie in the parking lot. You guys don't know what I'm talking about, do you?
I think he's talking about...
Let's pull out of this movie theater.
Cripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
Just because you may not see those bright red cranberries in the bogs right now this time of year, that doesn't mean that those growers are getting a vacation or even time off. I'm Charity Seemecker from the Midwest Farm Report, and Rochelle Beagle Hoffman is the owner of Rooted in Red Cranberries, located in Wisconsin Rapids. She explains what a day in the life looks like for her this time of the year.
Springtime is a little bit of a transitional period. Cranberry plants are perennial, so that means they don't get planted every year. So they are a plant that gets planted and keeps producing cranberries for over 100 years. So in the wintertime, after they're harvested, they go dormant. So you go from that really beautiful green, vibrant color, and they go to a really, really kind of dark burgundy purple color when they're going through their dormancy stage. So kind of through the winter and springtime, they're still dormant. And so we are kind of in that transition period as far as dormancy. And then in the springtime, our cranberries are kind of starting to wake up.
That was Rochelle Beagle Hoffman of Rooted in Red Cranberries. I'll have a look at your closing markets right after this.
Microbials play a critical role in the health and vitality of livestock. I'm Dr. Bill Zimmer, veterinarian and founder of BioVet, your leading source for high-quality microbial and nutritional products that support growth, health, and production in livestock. Listen to our Microbials Matter podcast at bio-vet.com as experts discuss health, digestion, and support for livestock. Visit bio-vet.com and click on podcast. Innovation, that's
BioVet. Looking to grow new ideas for your farm? Then visit the WPS Farm Show. For 62 years, farmers have been coming to the show for the latest in farm equipment, services, and technology to boost their business. Don't miss this year's show, filled with ideas to help you grow. Mark your calendar for March 26th through the 28th at the EAA Grounds in Oshkosh. For more information and a full list of exhibitors, visit wisconsinpublicservice.com.
I'm Charity Seebecker from the Midwest Farm Report with a look at your closing markets. Cash corn closed $4.39 and a quarter, down 1.5 cents. New crop corn closed at $4.75 and a quarter, also down 1.5 cents. Cash beans closed at $11.92 and a half, that was down 19.5 cents. And new crop beans closed at $11.87, down 17.25 cents. Cash wheat closed at $5.54 and three quarters, that's up 8 cents. And new crop wheat closed at $5.69 and a half, up 7.5 cents. April Class 3 milk contract is trading at $15.59, that's down 15 cents. And May milk is trading at $16.20, down 5 cents. Barrel cheese closed at $1.42 and a half, that's down 4.5 cents. 40-pound block cheese closed at $1.39 and a quarter, that was down a half. And the double A butter closed down 1.25 cents at $2.80 and three quarters. From the Midwest Farm Report, I'm Charity Seebecker.
Cloudy skies today with spotty snow showers still possible. By tonight, we'll see some clearing as temperatures crash cold. This means we'll see a mostly sunny day tomorrow with highs in the mid-30s. All ahead of a major snowstorm smacking by Saturday night and throughout Sunday. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot. Currently, it's 31 degrees.
Being blind doesn't always look how others may think.
Retinitis pigmentosa aimed to overwhelm my family.
It tried to cut me down.
I know where to find support and where I can be seen.
Innovative research, educational resources, supportive community. The Foundation Fighting Blindness is leading the charge in finding treatments and cures for blinding diseases. Learn more at fightingblindness.org. A public service message from the Foundation Fighting Blindness.
Tap into what Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley is talking about today. This is 93.5 The Tap. Online at thetap.fm. Time after time. If you're lost, you can look and you
will find me. Time after time. Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show. And time after time this week, you've had the opportunity to win a bike, a blender, or a trip. To Chula Vista, and this This is your second to last time, this segment and the next segment, for you to find your time to text in the word lawn. That's L-A-W-N, lawn. You know, that big expanse in front of your house or apartment that's covered in 3 inches or 4 inches of snow today? Yeah, that thing. Text in lawn and you may win. But you're definitely going to win with this next section from our guest hosts, Liz and Aaron. Take it away, friends.
Thanks, Anya. You are killing it with the dad jokes.
I try as best as I can for a 25-year-old woman. I'm full of dad jokes.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. It means a lot coming from a dad.
All right. So we are going to continue on with our conversation about what happened when Alaska in the mid-1970s decided that it was going to do away with plea bargaining. Okay, so practically, what happened? Did the system grind to a halt? It didn't. They did have a lot more trials. Unsurprisingly, the defense bar hated this, and so they took things to trial because they weren't being given incentive to do otherwise. But it was interesting that they were getting 50% not guilty verdicts when they took it to trial. And I found that really interesting, particularly in the face of screening now by experienced prosecutors and the bar being beyond a reasonable doubt instead of probable cause, and they were still getting 50% not guilty. Please, Aaron's making some faces. Do you have some thoughts?
The juries are fickle, and I tell victims that as well. When I'm talking about plea bargaining a case, I say, look, it only takes one or two jurors to throw you off, and I think you may have the most slam dunk case in the world, but you get one or two jurors that say, nope, it's a hung jury. But it's the same to me as a not guilty verdict, frankly. I could retry it, but, you know, if it's a hung... So for everybody out there, a hung jury in the criminal system, all 12 jurors have to agree you are guilty to convict you. It's not just one, you know, it's not a majority. In civil cases, it's not all 12. But in criminal, all 12 of those people have to agree beyond a reasonable doubt I've proven the case and you should be found guilty of whatever you are. The example I give to victims all the time is a personal one from when I was a prosecutor. I had a case that I consider to be as good of a burglary case as you get. Now, again, burglary, I touched upon this at the beginning, is when someone enters into your home without consent with the intent to steal from your home. It is a felony. This particular case occurred on the east side of Milwaukee. This particular defendant, and this is something the jury never hears, this particular defendant had a long history of walking over into a particular neighborhood and walking around till he found a door that was unlocked, going in and burglarizing.
Aaron, why doesn't the jury hear about that?
The jury doesn't hear about that because if I told the jury that this defendant has done this 20 times before, guess what? They would convict them the guy 100% of the time. So,
and you have to prove that he did it that time based on the facts,
yep.
Based on that time, not because he maybe had a propensity for doing this or had done it before.
Not because he's a bad guy, not because he's done it before, not because he's a career criminal, because on these facts alone is what you're judging him. So in this particular case, this was an area that had been burglarized in the past, and there was a couple of homes that were new, show homes, that hadn't been built, no one had moved in yet. They were still being shown for people in the neighborhood to potentially buy these houses. They had been burglarized several times, and as a consequence, they had alarm systems. And this particular evening, the back door gets alarm triggered, kicked in back door. Okay, that's what the police have. They get the burglary or the alarm company reaches out to the police. The police happen to be in the area. They happen to get to the house within a few minutes. And again, what they've been told was back door kicked in. They pull into the driveway. From around back of the house where the back door is comes the criminal defendant. He has a dining room table. He's carrying it on his shoulders, hunched over, down the driveway from the back of the house.
So our listeners can't see it, but I am watching Aaron look like he is carrying a giant table on his back.
Yeah, bent over, dining room table on his back.
And I'll provide the visual that Anya is face-palming at the idea of a man exiting the home with a whole table on it, I just have to say.
Correct. And so the police see this, stop. You know, they tell him to stop. He drops the table, he runs. They catch him. They never lose sight of the guy. Catch him a couple houses down. Boom. They then go around to the back of the house. Well, sure enough, the back door had been kicked in. And sure enough, the dining room table was, in fact, missing. And did the dining room table match the chairs that were still sitting there?
All right. Seems like you can connect the dots there.
That's about as strong of a burglary as you're going to get. And there is a thing now with the proliferation of TV shows, crime TV shows, we get what's called the CSI effect. Everybody expects, every juror expects there's DNA, there's carpet fibers, there's something. We covered for that. I talked to my detectives. Would you expect to find DNA inside the house here? No.
And are you talking about when you are questioning your detectives during trial?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those were the facts. There was no suggestion that anybody else had been around, et cetera. Goes to the jury. It hangs. Two jurors didn't think there was enough to prove because we hadn't definitively proved that that defendant had been inside the house, which is an element of the crime, to get that table.
Could have found the table outside after it was dropped by the real defendant burglar.
Within that 5 minutes. So that is the example I always give as to why there's a benefit to victims and to criminal defendants for plea bargaining, because juries are fickle. You never know what you're going to get. In that case, you know, I went and talked to those jurors and they asked me, does it ever get any better than that? And I looked at them, I said, no. And they're like, was he a bad guy? I said, well, he's done this 20 times before. Why did you tell us that? Because you can't convict based on that.
Well, so, and there's a reason you can't convict based on that.
But that's the example I give to victims with why there is a benefit to offering this defendant less time, because, you know, even though I think with beyond a reasonable doubt he did it, absolutely, the jury's not going to hear about those priors. And so there's always a chance. So,
all right, I'm going to fast forward then to 1991 in Alaska. The Alaska Judicial Council did kind of a look back. They issued this report called Alaska's Plea Bargaining Ban Reevaluated. All right, so we've been doing this for the last 16 years. What has changed? And here's what they found. They found increased police professionalism. I think good thing. They found that the changes in the screening practices really had the most far-reaching and positive effects. I think that makes sense as well. But they had found that although sentence bargaining had ended, which is what was happening before, I'll give you I'll recommend a shorter sentence than you would otherwise have if you pleaded guilty, that charge bargaining actually was occurring now. So we've had about 16 years of the no plea bargain ban. And the reason for that is because during that time period, Alaska's laws had changed such that there were, call it kind of mandatory charging, mandatory sentences for certain crimes. And so now if you're going to be convicted of felony X, you have to get a certain sentence. So the way you get around that then is you bargain the charge. So you bargain down to a charge that has a lesser required sentence. It was called presumptive sentencing guidelines. What it meant during that time period is that a lot of people were in prison in Alaska. Oh, yeah. The Alaska was number 4 in the country in percentage of population incarcerated. And then I think the key here is really how the economics played into this. So when the ban on plea bargaining started in the 70s, Alaska had lots and lots of oil revenues. In the mid-1980s, that went way down. And so in the 70s, they spent a lot of money on the infrastructure to put people in prison and to process defendants through the criminal justice system. By the 1980s, suddenly you have taxpayers saying, I don't think we want to keep paying money to build more prisons, keep people in them, make sure they're up to speed. And I think that's your incentive then also to start plea bargaining down again. So I'll give you another kind of small example that I found, that New Orleans, just the city itself, also banned plea bargaining also in 1974. It's kind of interesting that this stuff was going on in the 70s. So the district attorney of New Orleans was Harry Connick Sr. It was Harry Connick Jr.'s dad, which is kind of an
random fact.
Interesting, fun fact about the Connicks. And he actually he was elected the DA. He wasn't appointed like Alaska's attorney general was. He ran on a banning plea bargaining position. And he knocked the plea bargaining rate down from 60% to 8% while he was the district attorney. There were 190 trials in the last year of the DA before Harry Connick Sr. In the third year of Harry Connick Sr. being DA, there was 1,000. It was popular from what I've read. It was popular with the public because it was transparent. You kind of you see what you get, right? We said this is the charge and this is the sentence and that's what you're going to get. And it doesn't make it seem like the law is kind of flexible, particularly a concern of, hey, if you're wealthy and you can afford a defense attorney who can put lots of time into it, are you going to get a better deal? When Connick Sr. stepped down, the new DA didn't follow that procedure. And so in neither Alaska or New Orleans is that still going forward. And the last little jurisdiction that I found that tried this was El Paso. And it was, I just found a very short article about it that said that the district attorney said no plea bargaining and the court system imploded. That there was just way too many trials. They didn't have the infrastructure for it. They didn't have the money for it. The assistant district attorneys did not enforce it, and the judges didn't either.
And another thing to think about that, juries will hate that. If I put the jury in a box for 4 days in a case that I have overwhelming DNA evidence, say in a sexual assault or video evidence or overwhelming evidence of a homicide, and I make a jury, 12 people sit there for a week to hear this, and it's overwhelming, that's going to anger a lot of people in the public pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's interesting. That isn't something that I've read about, and that's an interesting... That's an interesting thought about it. I think we can probably feel comfortable with the idea that eliminating plea bargaining is probably not going to happen. I think that there are really valid criticisms about it, and I think it's something that we should keep in mind, and that we should, particularly because the kind of first line of defense is your prosecutors. I think it's something here in Wisconsin, since we elect our district attorneys, it's something that we should think about when we're electing our public officials. Are they giving the training that we want them to? Are the assistant district attorneys charging things correctly? And I'll make this plug because, you know, most of our listeners aren't lawyers. Most of my friends aren't lawyers. My neighbors aren't lawyers. Please talk to your lawyer neighbors and your lawyer friends about what's going on in the judicial system. You know, here in Wisconsin, we vote for judges, we vote for the DA, we vote for city attorneys, but most people don't have any idea who they should vote for, particularly if it's contested. Reach out to some folks and ask us about it.
Along those lines, we vote for our legislature.
Absolutely.
So those people are the ones that decide, you know, how many district attorneys can be hired. I mean, I'll tell you, all DA's offices are grossly understaffed in Wisconsin. And equally as important, all public defenders' offices are grossly understaffed. And the problem is, even when they are staffed, they're not paying. Wisconsin as a state, and I'll get on my pedestal here a little bit, underpays their prosecutors and their public defenders compared with states that are just as well off financially as Wisconsin is. And that, you're doing a great disservice to the entire system if that's happening, because you're going to lose people that otherwise would be fantastic public defenders and fantastically ethical prosecutors that do what's right all the time. You're losing those people because you're not paying them and you don't have enough of them. So the whole system suffers when that happens. So
I know this is something that the Wisconsin State Bar has been really active in trying to convince our legislators that more money needs to be given to our prosecutors, to our public defenders, to our private attorneys that are taking on those appointments. We made some progress, I think, a couple years ago.
Correct.
I think the rate went up for prosecutors and defense attorneys. I know it did for private.
Yeah. So the prosecutors, there's now kind of a step system in place. And I think with the public defenders as well, the question is whether that gets funded. So the public defender rate for referring cases, their overflow to private attorneys, that went up to incentivize private attorneys to take those cases as well, but it's still not really where it should be, but
to be continued.
Correct. If you fall, I will catch you, I'll be waiting, time after time.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, the Valley's home of Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
What if there is a murderer walking among us?
Follow the clues, solve the mystery.
This village really is a place where murder is easy.
Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, a brand new BritBox original series, is streaming now, adding to the largest collection of Agatha Christie, including Miss Marple, Poirot, Why Didn't They Ask Evans, and more.
The whole collection, it is magnificent.
Stream the best of British TV, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
She posted about us just now.
Celebrities can't get enough of Bianna's bespoke skincare line.
She has 147 million followers. How do we monetize?
She needs a social media associate to help her with the hype.
We should repost this. Do we need a hashtag?
Indeed can help her hire great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. You can schedule and conduct virtual interviews all from your employer dashboard. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, the Chippewa Valley's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
Freedom, freedom, I can't move. Freedom, cut me loose. Yeah. Freedom, freedom, where are you? Because I need freedom too.
Welcome back, Wisconsin, to the Maggie Dawn Show. The last little snippet of it this week. And one last chance. Seriously, this is your last chance this week. This is the end of the 3 p.m. hour to text in to our text competition, our Ride into Spring competition, one last time. If you want to get in your ticket to try to win a blender, a bike, and a trip to Chula Vista, you have to text us the word lawn, L-A-W-N, lawn. And with that, our guest hosts. Take it away, friends.
On the Shaw.
I
just wanted to say that as a lifelong Waukesha. I grew up in Waukesha.
So. I was going to say, Aaron, give us a little background.
It warms my heart to hear the Shaw. So I am a proud product of Waukesha Public Schools, Hawthorne, Butler Middle School, then Waukesha North.
Welcome back home.
Of course.
All right. So this is our last little segment. I'm thrilled that we've been able to talk about this topic for the last 2 hours. And I hope it's been interesting to people. And my sincere gratitude to Aaron for joining me today. It's been so interesting to have you here. Anya, you've been awesome looking at you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This is way better than 2 hours of dead air.
It's a low bar.
No. But you're setting a very high bar for me next week. So I'm happy to have you guys.
I understand you'll be talking about TikTok.
I will a little bit. I'm going to talk about the film incentives to try to get, we're trying to get that back in the state. And we're going to talk about, from a young person's perspective, the TikTok ban. Is it good? Is it bad? Why not? So, yeah.
I have daughters who would love to opine on that topic. So.
Well, tell them to call into our number next Tuesday, 85. I'll let you guys do your thing first.
Thank you.
So my husband will be very interested in the film incentives, though, because that's his background. And I know they're listening right now, so if it's okay, I'm going to give a little shout out.
Give him a shout out.
All right, my husband, Ed, my son, Ben, who's listening. Aaron, how about you?
My kids are probably not listening. So.
My cats are probably listening at home. We do leave the radio on for them. Perfect. So Betty, Nellie, if you're out there, listen up for about plea bargaining. You need to know about this, girls.
All right. So with our last little segment, I think what we ended on was, boy, it seems like eliminating plea bargaining is probably not going to happen. So what can be done to address some of these issues that we've raised today? So the American Bar Association has a criminal justice division, and it put together a plea bargain task force in 2023. And they put out a report, and you can just Google it, ABA Criminal Justice Plea Bargain Task Force, and download a copy of it. It's available to the public, and it's pretty easy to read and pretty understandable. And they give some suggestions of what they think would help the system and help guard against some of these issues that Dan Cannon raised, that Judge Fine raised, that our callers raised. And so I'm going to walk through some of those, and we're going to see what our listeners think. And Aaron, I'll look for your perspective as well. I'm going to start with one that, Aaron, I know you're going to agree with because you've already said it, that weak cases should not be settled. They should be dismissed.
They shouldn't be charged.
Yeah, exactly right.
Correct.
All right. That seems like a pretty easy one. So how about this one? All plea offers should be in writing and filed with the court. There's a concern that there's settlement discussions kind of going on off the record, right? It's no court reporter is taking it down between the prosecutor and the defense attorney, and they're kind of
conspiring is not the right word, but they're discussing settlement and in private, outside of open court. There's really no transparency about what's getting offered to who, and then what's the counteroffer, and then what's coming back. So what do you think about this idea of all plea offers in writing and filed with the court?
I don't think that in Wisconsin it doesn't need to happen, because in Wisconsin, when there's that plea hearing date, the judge initially says, state, what is your offer? And I put on the record in open court for everybody to hear and see exactly what my offer is. I'm offering to amend count one to this, to this, and this, and this is my recommendation. Defense, is that your understanding? It is. And in addition, it does get put in writing on the plea questionnaire that the defense attorney and the defendant fills out. So I don't think that necessarily needs to happen, at least in Wisconsin. But I think there needs to be something like that. So it's an open record. This is exactly what I've offered. This is your understanding too. And that's, everybody's on the same page. So.
And just for an explanation for our listeners who might not know, we talk about something being on the record a lot. And what that means is that there is either a court reporter typing it up, and it's part of a transcript that then you can order and have, and it's a written record. Or what we have a lot now is it's being audio recorded.
But that's not happening yet, at least in Wisconsin, for plea. When you're talking about taking a plea, that usually is a court reporter is actually typing it down, which is lots of times a recording. You may not catch it. Like if I back away now, you may not catch it as well as when I move in. So
yeah. Okay. How about this one? Threat of capital punishment or life without parole should not be used to induce guilty pleas. I mean, I think this is kind of your extreme example that really people do get very concerned about, because when your life is on the line, that is the maximum pressure to maybe accept a plea and plead guilty to something you didn't do.
I don't disagree with that. Mm-hmm. But as a practical matter, I mean, lots of times you have that, you know, the amount of exposure I have for 15 counts of something will take you through the end of your life anyway. Mm-hmm. So, I don't disagree with that, though.
How about charging decisions should be based on written policies that are publicly accessible? And again, it's this idea of transparency, that the public understands what's happening and why decisions are being made.
I'm not sure I agree with that, because there's a human element to all of this. So I may deviate. If there's a written policy that says I should charge this person with a felony, I may deviate the other way if I have information to me, you know, as far as I may not charge you with a felony. So I don't disagree with saying if there are charging guidelines that the prosecutor's office has that make those public, but I don't think you need to have them.
But do you disagree with the idea of having guidelines? I mean, it seems important to me that charging decisions should be generally standard amongst your prosecutors. That way it's not a, oh boy, you got Aaron. If you would have gotten Liz, it would have been way different.
I think the guideline should be, you should be able to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. I don't like the system of saying if X, Y, and Z, you charge the person with this. I don't agree with that. The guideline should be, can I prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? That's it.
All right, so Anya's telling us that we've got 1 minute left. I really would encourage people to explore this more. There's a lot of stuff out there. If you just Google it, again, this ABA Plea Bargain Task Force guide, it's short, interesting. Thanks so much for having us on today. It's been really, really fun. And maybe they'll invite us back again.
Maybe. Thank you.
Thanks.
Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
If anyone knows what's on tap, it's the Chippewa Valley. We're talking about everything that's on tap in your world today. 93.5, The Tap.
Hey everybody, Todd Alba. On Monday, noon till 2, we'll check in with our March Madness brackets and also update you on news over the weekend on the Civic Media Radio Network.
For the longest time, it was hard for me to even get out of the house, much less do a backside 180. It took me a bit to understand what was going on, but eventually I learned I had anxiety. Now I'm getting help for it and feeling so much better. Sure, some days are better than others, but the whole thing about getting out of the house, that's not really an issue anymore.
Mental health care is working. See what it can do for you at mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News special report. At least 40 people are dead, more than 100 wounded, after officials say there's been a mass shooting in Moscow.